Okay, well, welcome everybody. This is our second conference call for RM101, and I'd like to acknowledge that I'm hosting it from the beautiful traditional territories of the Kwamundung First Nation and Tsanquashin Council. And I must admit, I love this time of year because the sun is getting a little higher in the sky and the daylight's coming back. And given that we don't change clocks, it's actually light till after 8 o'clock at night, which is amazing. I love going home when, or actually I work from home, but I love the end of the day when there's extra light. So what I'd like to do is on today's call, we'll do some introductions and we'll do them around our circle rather than in the chat. Unless it's easier for you to pop in the chat, you're more than welcome to do that. And then we're going to go through a bit of this week's content and discuss some of the considerations that we have for managing risk in our rural, remote, and northern communities, because, and small communities as well. We touched on some of them last week, but we'll dig into a little bit further into some sort of special considerations. So let's begin with a quick round of introductions. When you introduce yourself, I'm wondering, and if you'd like to introduce yourself formally in the chat, go ahead, or you can introduce yourself however you would like as we go around. I'll try and do the order in which you joined the call, which, April, I hope you don't mind, that puts you on the spot first. So it would go April, Josh, Quentin, Acacia, Myla and Chanel, and then Melanie, and then Amory, I see, is on the call too. So we'll do that order. So I'll just ask you a question. We'll start right into sort of our content with our introduction. So when you introduce yourself, maybe you can just share, it can be one small thing, it doesn't have to be complicated, but something that the risk management consideration for the recreation work that you, or sport work that you do in northern, rural, and remote communities. So April, I'll ask you to start off if you don't mind, that would be great. Just to introduce yourself and share if it comes to mind, if not, just pass on the extra question.
My name is April Olusi and I'm from Oluchaktok North West Territories. I work at the hamlet of Oluchaktok as a recreation coordinator. I'll pass, but I'll type in my answer on the question shortly.
That's great. Thanks, April. Okay, let's go to Josh. Josh, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and if you have a consideration for managing risk in the communities that you work with, that would be great to share. And if not, you can pop that in the chat, too.
Hi, I'm Josh Sonnen. I'm calling in from Winnipeg, and I work with the Manitoba Aboriginal Sport and Recreation Council. I think one general idea that I always keep in mind when it comes to risk management, safe instructor to participant ratio to make sure everything's running smoothly and all the kids are looked after and accounted for.
That's great. So that ratio, making sure that it's safe. And when we're in more remote communities or working with maybe a wider age range of kids, which you sometimes get when you're in a small community, that's probably even more important. So thanks for that, Josh. And I see Acacia, you popped in the chat, so we'll come back to yours in a sec. Quentin, I'm wondering if you'd like to introduce yourself and share a risk management consideration that you have for the work you do.
Yeah, so my name is Quentin, and I am the North End Sports Coordinator for Manitoba Aboriginal Sports and Recreation Council here in Winnipeg. My job is within the city, so I don't really travel to northern communities and stuff like that. But the sports programs I run, more specifically the hockey program, each team is required to have a team safety rep, so someone who takes a safety course that has to be ready in case something happens with like an action plan and works well on coaches and stuff like that. So that's something that helps with risk management is having someone in place who's designated to make sure that they help with in situations like that.
That's great. That's a really good idea because although you're not working out in rural or remote communities, you're working with a community within a bigger community, right? So you have a community that might experience different risks than the broader region of Winnipeg or something like that. And Quentin, I just have one quick question. With your team safety rep, is that person a volunteer or is it like a paid coach?
No, it's just a volunteer. It's part of the benching staff, so it's a parent who offers to do it. It's up to the coaches to try and find one that's required for every team, so it's just a parent that steps up.
That's great. And is that something that's common across the sport in general, or is that something that you guys have implemented for your teams?
It's Hockey Winnipeg, and I think Hockey Manitoba requirements. So I'm not sure about other provinces and stuff, but I think it's pretty common across the country, I think so.
That's great. I'm not a hockey parent. I didn't raise hockey kids, so thanks for sharing that. But I do think that's really important, and to have that volunteer person, it takes that onus off the coach who's doing other important things. So thanks, Quentin. Let's go to Acacia. Did you want to unmute and introduce yourself, or are you in the middle of something and are just popping in the chat? Oh, sound's not working today, hey? Oh, yeah, there we go. Oh, now you're muted again.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure why it's auto-muting. I just put it in the chat just because I was thinking of it, and I was like, before I get to it, I might forget what I was thinking about, so I just put it in there quickly. But, I think one of the main things that comes up to my mind, at least during the winter programming, is cold weather risks, risk of frostbite, hypothermia, and even just risk that we have to cancel the program due to the weather. So that's something that's a constant thing I deal with. I think so all of our programming is outside with snowshoeing, kick sledding, noise walking, all that kind of thing. So it's always something that we have to keep in mind.
And you work with elders.
Yeah,
and you work with elders and seniors, so that's probably extra important, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's go to Myra and Chanel. Are you guys okay to unmute, or are you in the middle of things and just listening today?
So Chanel she just had to run to the office. Oh, she's here now, though. We are like in the middle of doing a lot of stuff right now, and we're pretty short-handed, but we're Myra and Chanel from CarMax. And I think for the risk management, a lot of it would be like identifying and addressing hazards, always having a go bag with the first aid kit, and then everybody having, everybody here has their first aid, and I'm on EMS, so I'm always getting further training on that as well.
That's great. So things like being prepared and having the right training. And I love that hoodie that you're rocking there. That's
great.
Hi. Chanel's in the background too. So thanks for joining us today. Melanie, over to you. And then Amory's popped in the chat, so I'll share what she's popped in.
I'm Melanie from Boston Lake, and I was just thinking while listening what others say about risk management in remote communities. Over here, I would say part of risk management would be maybe the lack of staff or volunteers to give proper supervision or follow-ups. So there could be a risk in these kind of things just due to lack of personnel. And then maybe also lack of training. Maybe not the staff so much, but the volunteers who often just jump on board for the event of the day because everything is super last minute, but then may not have the proper training or knowledge what to do, let's say, in emergency situations or with other situations where you have to eliminate risk or, you know. Yeah, so this is something that would come to my mind for now. I hope that answers the question.
That's great. I know it's a hard question to think about.
It is, yeah.
And you put the hoodie on too. Great. You guys all have For those of you who don't know, RPA stands for the Recreation and Parks Association of the Yukon. So it says have Yukon built hoodies that are RPA logos. So we'll have to share some with outside of the Yukon at some point in time. So thanks, Melanie. And Amory's popped in the chat. She's from also with the Manitoba Aboriginal Sport and Recreation Council. And she's grabbing some food. I thought that's a good thing to do at lunchtime. But some of the risk management concerns are not having the right equipment for the weather. And we definitely talked about travel and weather last week. So absolutely, Amory. And also, I really like this other point, not having updated equipment. So it could be updated equipment, whether it's hockey gear, helmets is something, whether it's playground equipment. So there's a variety of different things that you might be concerned about as far as updated equipment. April's mentioned sort of the teaching staff how to deal with risks, and Melanie took that a step further with volunteers and also having that first aid training. So thanks, everybody. Those are really important things that we consider, and it builds on our conversation from last week. So I'm just going to share the slides with you for those who can see it. And we're going to go through a little bit of content, and then I've got a number of questions for you to sort of dig into this a little bit deeper. So hold on while I present them here. And we're going to start with slide 15. So last week, we talked about approaching risk management in more of a disciplined manner so that we don't miss any of the key risks. And as you can see from our conversations, depending on where you work or the work that you do, a disciplined approach can be really important. And I really like the way Quentin explained having that team safety rep. I think that that's a really great approach to risk management, and it's disciplined because it's a requirement for each team, and it's not an extra responsibility of the coach. So I think that was a really good example to share. Thank you. Last week, we also talked a lot about the risk of injury. And I just want to be clear, this is quite an important concept, that injury is not the only type of harm or damage. Like physical injury isn't the only risks that we experience or the only harm or damage that can occur. So some of the other risks that we might need to think about and address are risks that lead to environmental damage. So if we're planning trails or parks, things like that, we have to be very aware of, are we encroaching on green spaces or things like that. Another thing that I'm thinking about are in the north, maybe not so much in Manitoba, but probably in northern Manitoba is permafrost and putting pools in where there's permafrost, and then you have challenges around that as well. There's also things like harm to your organization's reputation. So if something happens, then it can be what we call a reputational risk, either your reputation or your organization. So that's definitely something to consider. There's also things like vandalism to properties that you might be responsible for whether it's parks, playgrounds, or buildings, and also perhaps the theft of equipment that's left out as well. Sometimes there's a risk of data breaches. So if you have people's private information, like birth dates and social insurance numbers or whatever you happen to maintain, and somebody gets into your records and files, that is definitely a risk as well. So really, if you think about it, in reality, we can never get rid of or manage all the risks that are there. So instead, what we do is we just manage what's possible before we start or continue a program or event. So last week, in your required learning activity, you chose an activity or event and rated the risks in a couple of different ways. And this week, we're going to identify some of the controls that can be put in place following the steps 2 and 3. So we covered step 1 last week, and now we're getting into step 2 and 3 this week. So in step 1, as you know, we identified the major risks and also the issues or gaps. We rated it. So some of you, like Acacia, you did that for a kickflying program, and I like how you did 2 different parts of that same program. I found that a really interesting comparison to be able to see how you manage different risks and how things like your participants and their skill level and their fitness level influence the risk that you actually experience. And Holly from Fort Liard commented on a snowboarding trip and, you know, the realities, how the weather, which we've talked a lot about, might impact that too. So if I go to slide 24 now, which starts with step two, we can see that our next thing is to do something called a risk audit. And another word for that, if you don't like the word audit because it sounds like bookkeeping and finances, another word for that is just review. So what it means is that for every major risk that we identify, we look for controls or things that we can do to put in place to reduce the risk. So, Casey, if I can borrow your program, for example, you identify that you might have participants that have a lower fitness level and have less stability and balance. So the control that you put into place was to put in a different program that was shorter so that you wouldn't have the risks of putting in the program with people that were fitter, for example. And then we reassess the risk, assuming that we've put those controls in place. And there is always, always, always risk left over. Like, there's risk when we cross the road or when we, you know, go out of our homes or even in our homes. So we can't get rid of that risk, but that's called residual risk. And we'll talk about that shortly because that's a really important concept for us in recreation and sport. So the next thing that we want to do is, this slide is a reminder that we need to review risk in five key areas. So sometimes it's easy, our brain goes towards what we do. If we're involved in coaching, we might go towards supervision and instruction, or documentation or emergency response planning. If you supervise staff, you might be thinking more about the training. If you're responsible for facilities, that's maybe where your mind goes towards. But if we're really looking at risk comprehensively or as a whole, we need to look at these five risk areas. So the next couple of slides are pretty busy, so I just wanted to help you understand what they are. So slide 26 here, it shows a table that helps us list what the major gaps, issues, or risks are. And you can find this in the handouts. There's a link to handouts there. You can use that table to, and you can sort of print it off, and you can download it and fill in your own things. And it's got sort of some questions to encourage you to ask as well. And that really helps you dig into what they are. It's a good activity for those of you who work with others, like Myla and Chanel. This is something that you guys might want to do together because two brains might identify a greater variety of risks and come up with better solutions than one. The next slide, slide 27, shows us how this process works using a fillable form or a template. So we begin with one, describing what the major risks are. So maybe it's people, their fitness level. Then we rate each risk. What is the risk of them doing this activity, or what is the risk? Like, I know Amory mentioned weather, and we talked about travel last week. So what is the risk of somebody driving 500 kilometers in the winter to a small community? And then we identify controls to reduce risk. So that travel one, for example, maybe you have check-in times. Maybe if cell phones don't work, you take a different GPS device or something like that. Maybe if it's colder or the road conditions are rated below a certain level, you actually don't travel. So that you would identify those controls, and then you would determine how your risk has changed. So on this slide, you can see that for the example that's there, it's the blanket toss. Once the controls were put in place, the risk moved from moderate to low. And so that is, I know it sounds complicated, so I just want to pause and ask if anybody has any questions about that. You can either just unmute yourself and ask, or you can pop your question in the chat. I don't see any hands up or hear anything, so I'm hoping that I explained that clearly today. It could also be that you're very comfortable and familiar with this process too. So the next thing that we want to do is we're going to actually talk about this one rather than me explain it. So This is the idea of residual risk or leftover risk once we've put controls in place. So coming back to Quentin's example of having the team safety rep on the bench with first aid training and it's a volunteer, not the coach, that's a control that's put in place to reduce the risk of the severity of injuries that might occur. But there's still a risk of those injuries, even with that person on the bench. So I have a couple of questions to ask you, and because we've got a smaller group today, I'll just go one of the, actually I'll put all of them in the chat so you can have a look at them, and then I'll just go around and ask you if you have anything that you'd like to share, and you can say yes or you can say no or you can pop in the chat. So I'm not expecting an answer from you for every question, but I'll put all four in so you can see where you might want to answer or respond, and then I'm going to stop the slides just so that I can kind of have a look at everybody because they can't see what moves you all off to the side. So what we're going to talk about is in your roles, if you think about that leftover risk, how much is acceptable? How much is okay? Who decides what amount of risk is actually acceptable in the work that you do? And what can you do if after putting controls in place, the risk is still too high? So I'm not going to put April on the spot because I put her on the spot last time, but Josh, do you mind if I feel like you're okay with being put on the spot. So I'm wondering if you want to comment on one or any of those questions. And for everybody else, and Misha, hi, I see you joined the call. Sorry, I couldn't see you because the slides were up. Choose one or any of those questions, and the rest of you, I'll go around that circle again, and you can answer or you can pop in the chat. So, Josh, any thoughts about this concept of residual or leftover risk and how much is
it? I guess when I'm looking at the question of, like, how much risk is acceptable is kind of looking at maybe what is the goal of the program we're offering and who is the audience. So, you know, if we're playing, like, putting on a soccer camp for kids, the goal is for them to play soccer, and obviously that's not very risky. If the event, they may, like, hurt each other tripping over and stuff, but that's, like, not very likely. But, you know, you probably wouldn't provide, like, a program for skydiving for a bunch of 11-year-olds. Like, the risk-reward for that really is way out of whack, so that's something that we maybe consider not doing such an extreme event because it really doesn't help us achieve our goals because it's just so risky. So that's something maybe we would consider.
Yeah, so you'd really consider your participants and make sure that the programming is okay for them. And that I guess what I hear you saying, too, is that some risk is okay. It's normal. But really extreme risk for the wrong people is not a good match. And maybe not also when we work in public settings, like for a hamlet or a municipality, or when we work for nonprofit organizations, because we have a different responsibility than if we're running a private, I like your example of skydiving, a private skydiving business. So a little different, right? So thank you, Josh. Okay, going in the same order around the circle, Quentin, do you have any thoughts about what influences how much risk is acceptable, how much is okay, who decides, and what can you do if the risks are still too high? Okay, no worries. That's okay. Listening, remember, for me, listening is important too, so just thanks for letting me know if you want to pass. That's totally fine. So coming around our circle then, Acacia, what are your thoughts? Like, you're dealing with a different population group with elders and seniors. How much risk is acceptable or okay, and who decides?
It's a good question. I don't actually know what the answer would be, but my instinct is telling me that, like, I mean, I'm more on the cautious end, so I'm always kind of coming up with new versions of programs that suit, like you had mentioned before, the kick-sledding program. I created a new version that was for mobility and stability because I think it reduced the risk for a lot of our older members. I didn't want Elder Active to only focus on people who are 55 but fit. You know, I think that this is important to cater to the older populations that are older members. So for me, like, I don't want to have any kind of undue risk, but it's sort of a gut feeling on whether or not it's an acceptable level of risk. And some people will come in and be like, hey, I really want to try this thing, but we'll kind of try to assess them and their fitness level to see if it's the right program for them. And what I end up doing sometimes is redirecting them to a different program than they initially wanted to go into, or a different level. Like, there was somebody who was 90-plus that was in one of the Pilates levels, but she had a hard time keeping up just due to her age. She's very active, but it made more sense for her to be in the beginner level, even though she had experience, just due to her limitations. So it can be kind of a balancing act per person in our case.
So you're almost assessing risk in some cases for the individual person rather than the group as a whole, because there's probably a very broad range, as you mentioned, from about 55 plus to 90 something in the age group, in the age range. Just like as Josh pointed out, 11-year-old versus, you know, 25-year-old, for example, is very, very different. That's great. So what I've jotted down so far for those of you I'm coming around to is, some of the things then that really influence risk are our choice of the activities that we do, given the participants we either have coming to us or the participants we're programming for. So whether it's age, skill, fitness, type of program, those sorts of things. So going around our circle then, Myla and Chanel, is there anything, and I know you guys are busy, so just stay past if you're in the middle of something, but is there anything that you think about, like how do you decide if something's too risky or not, and what do you do if it's too risky?
So I don't really have a good answer to that at this moment, but we are having our Winterlude festival coming up here pretty quick, so we have modifications for each game. Like for nail pounding, we have large nails and large hammers for the adults, and then tiny little ones for the youth. And then, you know, saws, you have tiny logs for the saws, or for the youth, I mean. And then, and so on, so.
Great, so you change the equipment that you're using, or the materials or supplies, based on the participants.
Yeah.
Great. And correct me if I'm wrong, those of you who play hockey, but hockey probably does the same thing, right? There's probably different requirements for safety gear and protective gear for younger children and youth than there are for adults? Yes, no, maybe?
Probably. We're also going on our first hockey tournament, and we're so lost. So if anybody wants to help us with suggestions on that, we're more than welcome.
Okay, you got a couple of hockey people on the call, so pop it in the chat and maybe they'll answer you. Go ahead and pop that in the chat and see what answers you get. So always good to rack other people's brains for ideas.
Awesome.
So pop a question in the chat. What do we do with whatever it is you're wondering about with the hockey tournament? Thank you. That's what we're all here for, is to learn from each other. Okay, so let's go to Melanie, Amory, Nisha, and then April. So, Melanie, any thoughts about what influences this sort of residual or leftover risk, and how much is okay, and who decides? You might just have to unmute.
Partially participants decide, I think, how much risk they want to take. I'm thinking of team members, if they want to attend fitness classes, or people who haven't attended fitness classes in a long time, depending on the class, if it's yoga or aerobics or something, you know. So I think it's up to the participant, and then also up to the organizer to mitigate risk in the sense of providing a setup that helps participants to succeed, that may be making them aware when to stop, and just have safety measures in place in case something happens. I don't know.
It's a hard question to answer. It's not an easy one, and that's why if you're sort of struggling with an answer, it's because I think this is just a way of learning. Sometimes we have to talk through tough questions to come out with a different way of thinking about it.
Yeah, because to be honest, I haven't really thought about these, you know, kind of things. Risk reduction in mind, but and you want to be mindful of it, but to answer such questions.
Well, you also come from from Germany, where I know there's insurance for people even to have their own personal liability insurance. So if you spill, the way it was told me, if you spill your red wine on somebody's white pants, your insurance covers the cost of their white pants. I never heard of that in Canada before. But then in North America, everything's barricaded and things, they're not safe. And you go to Europe and you can walk on the edge of cliffs and things like that. So there's very different ways of thinking about risk and very many different situations. So it's hard to answer this question. So there is no right answer, but it's really important to think about it because this is a lot about what you do in your work and it's how you approach it and the programs and the services that you provide and who you provide it to. So it is good to think about it. So don't worry if you don't have the answer or any answer.
I feel like in this system here, in this society over here, it always is expected that risk is mitigated by government or by the organizer or, you know, while where I'm coming from is like you're taking a bit more care of yourself. To mitigate risk, you're more responsible yourself for it and not the other person, but because you can sue so easily here in North America, so everyone is way more careful about these kind of things, and it's not so common in Germany.
Yeah, exactly. So it makes it harder to think about, and we're also so close to the United States where it's even worse than what it is in Canada. So, you know, we hear their stories and it's like, okay, where do we land? So So thanks for sharing that, Melanie. Amory, I'm not sure if you want to pop in and share sort of your thoughts around who decides. I know, or you can pop in the chat. I know that we did talk about traveling to rural communities, and I'm kind of curious who makes the decision if you travel if the risk is too high or not, like who makes that final decision? Okay, so maybe Amory will pop in the chat. Nisha, do you want to jump in? I see that you joined us. What do you think with regards to risk? You know, how much is acceptable and who makes those final decisions?
I think what has been mentioned already is pretty much how I feel. The only thing I would add is kind of the end of the question, like if after putting controls in place, if the risk is still too high, that's where your forms come into place, where your ability and stuff, so that you're at least not responsible. So if they want to do like a skydiving trip, then when something happens and you're not liable.
Yeah, so what can you do if after putting controls in place the risk is still too high? So a waiver might be a type of control, but if the risk is still too high, you guys go ahead and pop in the chat while I come back to Amory, because I see Amory typing in to April. What do you do if the risk is too high even after you've put controls in place? Think about that and pop your answers in the chat. April, do you think about anything like how much risk is okay in your community, April, and who decides?
Who decides? I think would be mostly organizations or boards, councils would decide at the meetings, and also if it really depends on the risk, if it's like a minor risk or a high risk, if there needs to be something done, then there would be meetings on how to resolve those risks.
Yeah, and I think so it's a community thing in a way, like people would come together and talk about it?
Yeah, there's some boards, like for the Hamlet of Bullhook, we have a Hamlet Council Board makes decisions like that. If they know that there's high risks, then we would probably have to shut down the program for a little bit until we resolve the situation and find, you know, like better supplies to help these risks not happen.
So there's a huge advantage to what April's just described. Do you feel that because you have a board or a council that addresses that, April, it takes some of the responsibility off you?
Yes, but they do ask me to prepare those things and organize them so that it's properly organized,
Okay, so you sort of let them know what you're doing, but they also work with you to say if they're comfortable with that, what you come up with for the community or not. Is that correct?
Yep.
That's great. And I think that's a little bit in line with what Amory just popped in the chat. So Amory said that, you know, you might come together to make a decision. So I'm guessing, Amory, like, you might have a couple of people traveling to a community and you figure out if you're comfortable. I like how you go, we tell our supervisor and this is what we're going to be doing, and they usually agree most of the time. So, yeah, hopefully your supervisor would mostly agree with you. I think that that's absolutely accurate. Can you just let me know in the chat, Amory, if when you do travel in the winter, if you go by yourself or if you're going with somebody else? Because that's another sort of piece of this, too. And can anyone else think of what you might do? Like, Nisha's put in cancel it. If something, you know, if you've put controls in place and you're still got that kind of, remember we talked about sweaty palms? You've got that sweaty palm issue or you're feeling like something's still not right. Would you agree that you would cancel it, or what would, any other thoughts about what you would do? Let's just go around the circle again. Josh, what would you do if something just still didn't quite fit right with you as far as the risk?
I definitely think it was something that I would probably bring up to organization or management and sort of explain, like, this is the issue that I'm doing. This is why I think it's too risky, and maybe we should look at reassessing what we're doing or the activity or how we're going about it, because if you don't feel comfortable, you should probably trust your gut and speak on it or try and bring notice to it so we can address it.
Yeah, and I don't think it happens too much, right, in recreation and sport where we end up with something that feels really uncomfortable or too risky. Usually there's those outside factors like, you know, the weather's right around your cutoff temperature or something like that, and you're not quite sure. So, yeah, it's really good to be able to talk about it. So, like, going along the lines of what Amory and April Grove said. So thanks for that, Josh. Anyone else want to jump in? Just to put a couple of you on the spot, who it's easier when I see your faces. So, Melanie, you said you do the same as what Josh explained. Nisha said that. Myla and Chanel, go ahead, Melanie.
Maybe to add to Josh's statement, what he just said, is that especially when you work to management, often they have maybe a different avenue you can approach to maybe solve the problem or, you know, just other capabilities as we do have in our positions. So I think it's a good idea to talk to management about this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because really that's why you have a supervisor or a manager, somebody with the final say, right? Because if something bad really does happen, you don't want it to come back just on you or come back on the fact that you didn't raise your concerns or anything like that. I was checking, checking CDC this morning in the CDC North web page, and in Vancouver, there was like a unsanctioned, that they said was sanctioned, martial arts tournament, and there's a lawsuit about it now. It happened at Simon Fraser University, and I was like, wow, that really, you know, brings into mind the importance of good risk management, and if something doesn't feel right, making sure that you don't follow through with it. So, so thanks for those. Those are tough questions, but really think about, you know, what influences, how much risk is acceptable, how much is okay for you, because it's different for each person in each organization. Who decides? Ideally, bounce it off your supervisor or you, the board or a committee or other staff people, so that you can decide as a group. And also each program. Thank you, April. So back in the slides, there's one slide at the beginning, and it talks about, let me just scroll back there. Slide number 16. So let me just share that one with you. I just want to show this one once again. So slide 16, what I'd like to point out here is it reminds you that the things that really can affect what we're doing are the programs, the facilities, and the people. So we talked a lot about the programs and the people. And with facilities, also consider that it's not just the facility where you're at, but it's also the facilities for those of you who do travel, whether it's road or air or other land-based means like snowmobile or something like that. That is also could come under facilities. So it's the means that you actually get or use those places where you're at. So really keep those three things in mind, that they all combine to kind of influence how you feel about risk. So where we go after that is once you've sort of determined, you can put into place an action plan. And this is something that's, it doesn't have to be complicated, but if you keep this in writing, so if you're doing, like I'll use Quinton's example again about the hockey and having the team safety rep. So the risk area could be injuries in minor hockey or whatever the league is called. The action could be to make sure that there's always a team rep who is not the coach. And then the second action would be to make sure that that person has first aid training. And the third action would be to make sure that they have equipment and supplies and that they're there. Another action might be to have a backup person in case that person can't make the game. And so who's going to look after it? Is it coach's responsibility? Is it the league's responsibility? And when would that happen? So if you have those things written down in an action plan, keep them with your program design, because if something ever came up in a court of law, this shows that you're paying attention to risk and that you've done what we would call your due diligence to manage risk. So really important to keep that. So for the last little bit of the call, because we have a smaller amount of people, I'm just going to share this special considerations slide. And we've talked a lot about weather. We've talked a lot about travel. But we haven't talked so much about things like organizational structure or food or alcohol. And sometimes these are other considerations as far as risk. And I'm just going to pop a question in the chat here to you. And I'm going to open it up. I'll go around the circle. You can pass if you want. But these are some of sort of the things that I call special considerations. And I'm just wondering if you experience these things in what you do or anything else, what else would you put into place or do to manage some of these special considerations? So I will leave the slide up so you can see it. Myla and Chanel have also popped in response to our last discussion, you know, communicating issues and explaining why you don't feel comfortable and coming up with a solution. So really, really important. So I'm going to, let's start with Acacia for this round. Acacia, do you have any other special considerations that we haven't talked about as far as risk? Maybe to relate to some of these things, maybe it's something else that comes to mind?
I think for other special considerations could be with an older population, you have potential for like dementia and that kind of thing that can potentially add to another level of risk in the activities themselves, and or hearing or vision issues. Those are some other things that come to mind as something to be aware of. Obviously, that will be dependent on the people participating, but it's something to keep in mind, I think, is maybe special considerations not listed on here.
Yeah, that sometimes with seniors and elders, you might do like use a screening tool for fitness, but that doesn't necessarily catch things like dementia or anything like that. And do they need an aid with them or those sorts of things? So that's great. Thank you for sharing that. Myla and Chanel, do you guys encounter any of these special considerations in the work that you do? If so, you know, what are they and how would you manage them?
Yeah, I'd say we definitely do. A recent example is there's an association that rented out our facility for an event and they had a liquor license. So we do have a protocols and rules list. I believe that not everybody read it. I very strongly believe that. And so we did run into a lot of issues. They didn't really listen to any of our suggestions. We had a couple meetings about it prior, and yeah, they just didn't really listen. So I think going forward, we will be adjusting these protocols to better fit. Like, it's kind of a blessing that it was so rough, because now we know worst case scenario, right? So we're going to
they're going to adjust the protocols and make sure that you sit down with everybody that's in charge of the event individually instead of just one person from the board.
Yeah, that's great because, it, you know, when you're talking about things like a liquor license and alcohol in your facilities, you're actually, even if you're renting out that facility and you're trying to put all these things in place, it's still your facility, right? So it can come back on you as the owner of the facility as well if something happens.
And, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a really good point. Thanks for sharing that. Melanie, any thoughts about any of these extra special risks, like anything you've encountered in your work that might be a special consideration we haven't discussed and what you would do to manage it?
Maybe speaking to alcohol is not allowed in our facility. But what we encounter, and this is something I actually right now have to take care of, is that people come into the facility intoxicated and have alcohol filled probably in their water bottles or something, because by the time they're leaving, and these are adults, they're even more intoxicated. And they're using our youth center to just sit and talk. And they're not a harassment to the center. It's just like... having youth exposed to this behavior, people sitting there, obviously having the smell of alcohol in the room, having the smell of really strong pot in the room, where this is something I'm not quite sure how to approach it. This is something that just came to my attention just recently. And so this is what I'm dealing with right now, and this is where I feel the risk is for youth to. It's not like a physical risk, it's more of a risk that I use as seeing that they're exposed to this kind of behavior, and I don't like that.
So is it kind of like you're giving the youth a safe place to be, and you're trying to role model positive lifestyle behaviors, and it's difficult to do when you don't have those role models there, I guess.
Well, the thing is, like, we have a youth center that is more for youth, but these people are sitting in this youth center, and it's also cold outside, so I don't want to send someone in front of the door, but that I don't really want to facilitate this, and because I only started this job, like, last June, there's no policies and procedures in place in this building, like, nothing. That's why I'm also doing this course in the other. To learn on how best to implement all these things. So I have the example. I don't really have the solution that I can give you of what to do because it's a
tricky situation. Yeah.
Yeah.
If anybody has any answers or suggestions for Melanie, maybe just either put your hand up or pop something in the chat, and I'll come back to you with that. So that is. Definitely something, you know, you don't want to put people's health at risk by kicking them out when the weather's not good or anything like that. And we do know that, you know, there's substance use concerns in many, many of our communities. But we also want to have a positive environment in our recreation and sports spaces. So definitely a challenge. So if anyone has any suggestions, feel free to jump in or at least pop your name in the chat. I've got an answer to Melanie, and then I'll come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Amory, I don't know if you have any thoughts about any of these special considerations. I really appreciate what you've shared about travel as well. I don't know if food's so much of a concern. I think, you know, sometimes if you're providing food, we might need to worry about food safety and having the right certification and things like that. So I don't know if you have any other thoughts that you wanted to pop in the chat. I see that both Amory and April are popping in the chat, so that's great. And where did we start that round? Did we start with you, Josh, on this last round, or are we coming back to you? Oh, Misha, sorry. Let's go to Misha, and then we'll come back to Josh, because I have a feeling I started with a Casey on that round. So, Misha, any thoughts about these special considerations, and like, are there any others that come to mind?
The only thing I can think of is, like, I personally really hate having events with alcohol, because there's so many more risks associated with the programming. Like, when I was in Beaver Creek, we were building garden boxes, and somebody came in intoxicated, and, you know, he was really excited. He was, like, a cartoonist, so, like, just laid his route, but he was super drunk, and it was really uncomfortable for me to be like, you have to go home, especially when, like, because it was such a, it's such a small community, the participation numbers are low, and it's always just, like, a such a big thing to have, like, one or two people that come, and, yeah, and then, like, afterwards, we ended up tripping on, like, a stub, and, like, he had, like, this super bloody layer, like, a technical thing, so since Blair Creek, I'm really not into having alcohol at events, but I also know, like, sometimes that's just the reality of things, and, yeah, it's good to just have some extra cautions to when those events happen, but it can be anything up in when there's extra input.
And sometimes it can be alcohol-sanctioned events that are yours or that a group has, like what Myla and Chanel explained, or it can be more the, what do you do about the person in the community that's come to your event. So two really different things, and definitely challenges both ways. It's easier to put policies in place around what happens in your facilities rather than the people who come in, because we're in small communities, and kind of limiting people's access is tough too. April's talked in here around travel. So yeah, for those of you who don't know where April's from, look up Uluhoktuk. I practiced a long time to say that. I don't still say it quite right, but it's up in the Western Arctic. And things like, you know, making sure that you take a sat phone or an InReach, because sometimes when you're far out of town, you lose communication. Daily check-ins to make sure playgrounds are safe for kids and things like that, and especially for special needs participants. So that special needs, I think, is referring perhaps to children and things like that, but Acacia also mentioned that in the context of elder programming. Melanie said, how do you even say anything if alcohol isn't visible, but people are visibly intoxicated? That's a tough one to answer. Because how can you actually even prove, like, you can't accuse or blame people, because, you know, it's a very different situation. We don't know what's going on in people's lives, right? So I don't know what the answer is to that one. If anyone knows what the answer, go ahead and pop in the chat. And I'm just going to come back to Josh and then Quentin to see if there's anything else. Josh, do you have any of these special considerations come into play for you, or is there anything else that you really have to consider?
I mean, for our programs, we usually provide some sort of snack at the end for the kids. So I guess the one consideration for food is allergies. I don't think we always know allergies of every single kid going into the event, so usually we'll just, like, play it safe and get things without peanuts in, because that's usually, like, the major thing, or just allergy-friendly snacks. But I think, you know, sometimes it's important to maybe inquire about the participants in your program and say, are there any major food allergies, and then provide them alternative snacks or whatever item that they're allergic to make sure everyone can be safe and enjoy the food.
Yeah, because especially if you're in a small community and it might be a little ways to, like, advanced emergency care or anything like that, that's a big thing, right? Because a really severe allergic reaction often requires more than just a single EpiPen dose. So definitely good considerations around food, so thank you with that. And I think the other thing with food that I popped in there is, I know serving food, like if you have facilities where you're preparing especially hot foods or meats or things, making sure that you follow the guidelines around food preparation and perhaps have somebody who's certified too. Quentin, Quentin, I'm not sure, did you have any other special considerations that you wanted to share? You can pop in the chat or unmute.
This is kind of playing off what Josh was saying, but whenever people register, like any participants register for any of the programs I run, for any sports, one of the things I include in the registration form is medical concerns / allergies. So if they have any allergies, like, they can write those down so the coaches are aware and we're aware of what they may have. And medical concerns, things like asthma or, you know, anything else that's should be known, you know, do they take medications and stuff like that. So, because that gets passed along to, for hockey, it's supposed to get passed along to the team safety rep as well, so they have a bit of a binder of information for each player and stuff like that. So, yeah.
That's great. One would hope that parents fill those out comprehensively, or guardians at least, fill them out enough that you've got the right information and that nothing's really forgotten, because that can be challenging, especially when you have kids that are, you know, children or youth, as in minors, in your care. You definitely have a higher level of duty that's owed to those youth or the minors. So thank you for sharing that. I just noticed the time. We're 1 minute after. So Mylon Chanel has popped in a response to Melanie. If anybody would like to stay on the call and talk about this issue a little bit more, I'm happy to stay on a bit longer. But I recognize that I want to respect your time. So I'd like to stay on after I end the conference call recording if you want to chat a bit more. But thank you for joining today's conversation. And your final required learning activity is due on Sunday, and you'll find the information in activity number 6. Once we're done the call, I encourage you to go back to go into activity number 5 and answer the same question you answered last week. I just would like to compare responses from one to the next. So go ahead and do that. And please remember that we have a feedback that's really important for me, because I do use feedback to inform changes as we go along with the learning events. So feel free to stay on. I'm going to end the conference call recording. And remember, no call next week. So the next one will be March 14th already. So Guanashish, which is thank you in Southern Tichoni, Nelsi, Masicho, Kwana, which is in how we stand up in Uluhastaf, right, April. So have a great rest of February, which is all of today. And we'll talk to you soon.